Movies You Should See is sponsored by Simply Everything. Visit simplysyndicated.com/everything to hear our entire back catalogue, new episodes before they're available as podcasts, and exclusive shows made just for Simply Everything, including every episode of Movies You Should See and the new series of Make It So. Hello, welcome to Movies You Should See. This week, we're discussing the very serious Devil's Backbone from 2001 by Guillermo del Toro. Thank you. We have a wonderful cast of people to talk about this film tonight. Alison Downing.
Hello.
We have Matt is here. Hi, Matt. Welcome back to the show.
Greetings.
Scott's
here.
Thank
you much.
Scott's here too.
I would have memorized a greeting in Spanish, but... No.
Try. Hola.
There you go.
Hola.
And Greg's back with us again. Welcome back, Greg.
Hello.
He's being scary, Greg. That's
scary and silly.
And this isn't even the Halloween episode.
Is it not?
No.
Well, yeah, I suppose that's
a good
thing.
This is just
really,
a random...
It's not really a horror film.
It's not a horror film. It's no Ghost Watch.
It's no for a second, I thought we had pipes with us, but it's just Greg.
It is. He sounded a lot like it. Right then. Let's start with a little brief summary of feelings from everybody. I think let's start with Greg tonight. Greg, what did you think of this film?
You know, when I got to the end of the first reel and I had to stop for a bit and take care of some things, and I thought to myself, this is almost more of a mystery than a ghost story. And I think I stick with that all the way through to the end, that there may be a ghost, the ghost may be a character in the story, but truthfully, it's us following this drama in a fairly grim setting with fairly grim circumstances, sorting out the mystery that's kind of started it all.
Matt, what are you thinking?
I enjoyed it. It was pretty much the opposite of what I was expecting from a Guillermo del Toro movie. Not that I've seen a lot of his work, but I know of it. And I do agree that it's definitely a mystery sprinkled in with a little bit of a revenge flick, especially at the end there. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was actually pleasantly surprised.
Awesome. I think this is going to be a positive one. Scott, what did you think of The Devil's Backbone?
I hated every moment. No, I just wanted to make you think that we were going negative for a second. No, yeah. I had a good time with it. It was not as horrific and frightening as I expected from this director, and especially having a title like this. Mm. It didn't give me really what I was expecting, but that wasn't a bad thing at all. It was very... graceful, I think, is the best word that I can use to describe it. Mm. As with most of his work, he was very, very particular with how he put this together. It was scary when it needed to be, but at the same time, everything, even the ugly, quote unquote, parts, were still always beautiful.
Mm. Cool, Allison, your go. I didn't forget you this week.
No, you didn't. I'm grinning like a Cheshire cat that you guys feel the same way. I adore this film. I kind of adore anything that Del Toro does. But I think that this is his most beautiful piece. I agree that it's got that kind of elegance about it, and it's really mature. It's not just a ghost story. It's certainly not horror. And there's a lot of symbolism there about the Spanish Civil War, and it's quite deep if you want to really peel it all back. But on any level, it's just a beautiful film, and I love it.
Okay, then. You okay?
Yeah.
Got it. Let's have at it, then. I think the biggest misconception about this, and you all kind of mentioned it in some way of a bit of a surprise, this isn't a horror film. It has a ghost in it, but it's not a horror film.
No. Again, it's definitely a mystery.
Absolutely. And a revenge film.
Yes.
And a bit of a heist movie, if you want to look at it like that. And a war film. Not quite a family drama. It's set in a sort of an ad hoc orphanage in Spain during the Civil War. And the orphanage is looking after leftist kids, basically. But the people who are opposed to Franco. And they're under threat. You know, we see right at the very beginning that there's an unexploded bomb in the courtyard of this place. It is a target. The troops assume that activity's going on there. And we've got this place run by an old guy called Dr. Casares, yay! And Carmen, who sort of run it as sort of ad hoc mum and dad. And then there's a janitor called, can I do this? I don't know that I can.
I can't do it.
Jacinto.
So.
Jacinto?
Jacinto.
Yeah. Jacinto. I didn't hear the... You see, I heard Jacinto. No, not Cinto. Jacinto. I don't know. Is anyone Spanish around?
I went to high school with someone with that name, so it is Jacinto.
Jacinto, okay. Right. He was a former pupil of the orphanage, and he's now a janitor. And he's having it off with both a teacher and Carmen. And we don't like him immediately because he's a bad man. And he treats the children badly.
He's got a look of a bad man about him as well.
He's a bad man.
He is. He's got the hair of a bad man. It's all greasy and everything, which is never a good sign.
Is that never. What bad men look like in the Spanish Civil War?
Yeah.
Was I the only one who saw him in this film and thought for just a moment that we had the J.J. Abrams Spock as a character in this movie?
A little bit, but he's better looking than Zachary Quinto. There, I said it.
I was getting more of a Spanish Christopher Lee from the Dr. Casares than anybody else.
Oh, yeah.
He is, isn't he?
He is, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Spanish Christopher Lee.
But instead of a Hammer star, more of a soap opera star version of Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
Right.
To me, the real casting coup was somehow being able to go back in time 25 years and casting a young Benicio del Toro as Carlos in the starring role. I don't know how he did it.
Yeah,
which is both a compliment to the performance and a comment about his looks.
He's a great little actor. Let me find it. Fernando Tielve, who's got an adult picture of him on IMDb. So he was in Pan's Labyrinth in 2006. What else is he? Erica's Eyes this year. So yes, he's working.
I need to watch Pan's Labyrinth again. I don't really remember much about it.
See, that's more of a fantastical horror. And I think that there's elements of Kronos as well, which is his first film, that have got dark horror about them. So it's definitely a theme that he touches on in all of his films, and it depends on the film on how much he pulls that darkness out. And in this, it's incredibly restrained.
I'm surprised at how... I don't know. It kind of feels like he's not directed many films. In fact, he's not really directed many films, to say what a big name Guillermo del Toro actually is. And of those films, one of them is Blade 2. So that can't count, really. you know, and Pacific Rim, Hellboy, Hellboy 2, Pan's Labyrinth, Devil's Backbone, Kronos, and Mimic, which I still haven't seen. I didn't know that was him. But I keep meaning to watch
it. Yeah, neither did I. My experience is limited to the two Hellboy movies.
And now, I did enjoy Hellboy 2 a great deal, and Pacific Rim, actually. In fact,
I haven't seen that one yet.
Pacific Rim is a fantastic movie. It's don't go in expecting anything more than giant robots fighting monsters. That's what you get for an hour and a half.
I wouldn't expect anything more.
Yeah, it's absolutely perfect at being giant robots fighting monsters. That's what he intended to make. That's what he's made. I can't fault it in the slightest. It's not the next Godfather, But that's not what he was trying to make. He was making a summer blockbuster movie, and it's awesome. Yeah, I think you'll like it. I think you'll like it if you can get on
excellent
films like that, and I think you can. You'll be fine. If anything, I would say Guillermo is a much more prolific executive producer. In fact, when you look at his producer list, it seems you can't really make a project without him turning up and producing it. Kung Fu Panda 3. Like, how... you know, how has that happened? You know, Puss in Boots. Kung Fu Panda 2. Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. It just goes on and on and on. So many films he's produced.
I'm pretty sure that if someone were to ask me to name a film that you find most likely for Del Toro to be attached to, I'm pretty sure that I would list all the movies before I got to Kung Fu Panda. Mm. Like, all the movies.
But I think...
Touch of Evil would come on my list before Kung Fu Panda. And since we haven't gotten to that episode yet, we'll just clarify. Touch of Evil was made 1958.
Yeah, I think... Oh, it's
and
just...
It was a cassette producer on Puss in Boots as well.
How does this happen? What is going on?
Well, he's really good at making films, that's the thing. And he did a lot of work early in his career on makeup and stuff like that. So, and he's taught film. So he's a bit of an artist and can lend quite a lot, I think.
I don't doubt his ability.
I have no idea. This happens clearly over a couple of tequilas in a bar.
Yeah, it's just how when you're putting together the crew that's going to make Puss in Boots, at what point do you think, have you seen Pan's Labyrinth? We need that guy in here. And everyone goes, but it's a kid's animated film with a cat. Like, no, the guy who does the monsters really well, we'll get him in.
I'm talking of doing the monsters really well. If there is a monster in a traditional sense, it's the ghost up first. Because ghosts are always monsters up first until...
Seemingly unfairly.
Unfairly, yeah, because why else are they here except to try and tell us something?
We always assume it's a bad ghost.
But I can remember seeing this film for the first time quite a long time ago now and being absolutely breathtaking by the effect of a ghost in water that could move towards you but was still perceptibly in water. And it still blows my mind now when I first see Santi appear out of the shadows in full and you get to see the effect around him. It's just lovely.
Some of the misunderstanding is Santi's fault, because when your first conversation with somebody is so many of you are going to die.
I know. Why do ghosts always do that? Why do they always do that? You know, get out, you will all die. No, they shouldn't do that. It's like, hi, my name's Santi.
But
you should hear what happened to me.
That's how film and television works.
Well, exactly. If it weren't like that and you just met him and he sat down and chatted and explained why he was a ghost, then we won't have a film.
Look at that last episode of Doc Martin the other week. It's exactly what happened. Oh,
yep.
His wife's got... I'll just explain the Doc Martin reference. His wife's gonna get on a plane. She's going to Spain.
She's had enough of him.
Well, whatever the reason, that's what's happening. But what she doesn't know is that she's got, what is it, a brain hemorrhage or something?
No, she's got a pulmonary embolism.
And she gets on the plane, she'll die. And so he phones her up to stop her on the way to the airport. And all he'll say is, don't get on the plane.
Yeah.
Just don't get on that plane until she gets annoyed and hangs up on it. And then you have to have a 20-minute chase to the airport. But he didn't just say, don't get on the plane.
You've got pulmonary embolism.
You're going to die.
It's going to go off while you're in the plane and die.
So whatever you do, do not explain yourself adequately.
It's not about me this time. It's about you. But you didn't. Don't get on the plane. Many of you are
yet
dying.
Another situation. as we see in so many movies and so many TV shows, just an additional, you could do it in as few as usually 4 words. If you just toss 4 words in there, it's going to change the entire course of the plot. But for some reason, you don't put in those 4 important words, and people just think you're being crazy.
Yeah.
If Santi had just said, and it's not me, then that could change things up. So many of you are going to die. But not because of me. Okay, that's 5 words. But still,
Or even said, Jacinto is bad.
Right?
Or just,
if that wasn't obvious enough.
That dude killed me. Just like, it was him.
It was him.
I think Carlos and Santi would have gone along great, because Carlos probably would have said, well, hey, at least there's a ghost, because there's nothing else to do around here.
Exactly. There's just a bully and then some kids who follow the bully. I mean, we're in the middle of nowhere.
They've got slugs to play with, and they've got, of course, you know, Carlito's comic books, which for some reason he is completely okay with sharing with the rest of the group, even though they steal his things, they make fun of him, they call him a faggot, they almost stab him.
Yeah.
Then they wake him up in the middle of the night and say, show us your comics. And he does. What's with this kid?
I don't know.
He just wants to be liked.
He does, but he does it in the most kind of... Well, the bullies are everywhere, aren't they? And if you're a bully in a big fish pond, then you're going to be a bully in a little fish pond. And he's hurting. But we kind of... We don't really... We have that revealed to us over time that Carlitos is hurting. Oh, am I thinking of him? Yeah, I'm thinking of him. Sure, Paz.
Do you know what? This is going to sound terrible. This is one of the films where I just won't bother at any point attempting to take in names of characters. Won't even bother trying. That's it says more about me than anything else, but that's where I am with it. It's kind of like Game of Thrones. Cause that's the thing, I don't have any experience with Spanish people. I know one Spanish person.
Mm. Two.
Do I know two now?
Lavinia and Pablo.
Oh, that is two.
Yeah.
But generally on a massive level. No experience with Spanish people whatsoever. So a Spanish name means as much to me as anything from Game of Thrones. It might as well be a made-up word. It kind of is, but just not only to me.
Well, Guillermo is Spanish for William.
I don't know how we do that with names, by the way. It's a different name.
So is
how do we say that Edward it's the same?
Eduardo.
Yeah. I don't know. It's odd. It's an odd thing humans do. But yeah, I'm not saying that Spanish people are like Game of Thrones characters or anything. Although that's not the worst thing in the world. Well, it depends who you are, doesn't it?
It does, really.
Yeah. But that's for another podcast. Who else do we have to talk about in this film apart from the director? This is the trouble we have with foreign films, Alison.
Why?
Because we have an executive producer. We have an executive producer and an actress to talk about, because Guillermo del Toro is so intent on being an executive producer for other people's projects because of the influence of Pedro Almodovar.
Exactly.
Who saw one of his early movies and said, I want to executive produce your next film.
Yeah.
And so Del Toro picks this screenplay he's had for like two decades and says, well, if I've got Almodovar involved, then let's make the movie I really want to make.
Yeah.
I had no idea he was involved in the making of this film.
He's a producer, and his brother Augustin is as well.
And looking at a picture of Pedro now, he looks nothing like I expected.
Really?
I don't know what I expected, though. Somebody very odd looking, I think, was what I expected. He looks like a nice, normal, friendly person. Like anyone you might meet. And that's not what I expected him to look like. I expected him to be on.
Films.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. He's worked with Marisa Paredes before. She was in All About My Mother. And I've been mesmerised by her. Just the way that she looks and has looked over time as well. I just think she's one of the pinnacles of... Spanish women in at that time of their life, and she plays Carmen so well. This is a woman and a character I recognize from watching Almodovar films.
Yeah, she goes all the way back to Dark Habits.
Oh yes, yeah, she does.
Really, pretty early on.
Yeah, very early on. Yeah.
What was the one I saw?
I don't know. What was the one you saw?
The one with the wing.
Oh, Kiki and Pom Pom.
Which one?
Yeah, it's not a great one to start with. Kiki and Bon Bon. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen that. No.
It's tough. It's one of his toughest films to watch.
This was about the time that you basically discovered Pedro Almodovar.
Yeah, I bought two box sets. I bought pretty much every film that he'd done.
It was like all you were watching were this guy's films, and you got me to watch one.
It was too much.
By God, it was. Well, that was. I didn't expect it to come from this man that's smiling at me here on my iPad now. He looks so happy and he looks like he'd be your uncle. And a fun uncle at that. Not a creepy uncle. But we know better. We know he'd be the creepy.
You act like those two concepts are mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Like he can't be funny and creepy.
I think.
Pelucci, Bon Bon, and Other Girls Like Mom. That's the film from 1980.
Right. Yeah. Don't start with that one.
It's a tough one. I think by the time you get to sort of Life Flesh, and then definitely All About My Mother, that's where Almodovar really, really starts to become something that I can't not watch.
Was it Bad Education that Craig had trouble with?
Bad Education made Craig uncomfortable to watch, yeah.
Okay.
I think it's one of his most spectacular films, but... Hey-ho.
Well, he's definitely good at making films that make people feel a little bit uncomfortable and confused. I can't knock him for that whatsoever. What were you going to say, Greg?
I was going to say that, you know, the Devil's Backbone has sat on my DVR for well over a year now. I had this notion in the back of my mind that I had it already and that I just needed to watch it. But I had to scroll back so far because... If you start your partner off with the wrong movie, you can lose a whole genre that way.
Mm.
Cheryl and I went to see The Silence of the Lambs without knowing anything about the movie whatsoever.
Wow.
She doesn't like scary movies to begin with.
Oh my goodness.
But
what
she likes Jodie Foster. Well, I didn't know either. I thought Jonathan Demme, I like him. He didn't stop making sense. We'll
He's
watch his
nice
movie.
He's a nice man.
she's in it for the Jodie Foster bit, and it's like, wow, you just knew like 15 minutes in that this was not going to be a good experience. And she now will, it's not just horror films. She never would watch those.
Yeah.
But now what I would call The Devil's Backbone is kind of a thriller, and she's tossed all the thrillers out too. I mean, her tolerance level disappeared underneath the experience of Anthony Hopkins.
You see, I do think that's a horror film. It's bizarre.
Well, yeah, that one is, sure.
I'm not surprised that she kicked off about that one.
Silence of the Lambs is a thriller. It's a good thriller, but I think it's a thriller.
No matter how you describe it, just sending somebody in who doesn't like being scared with no warning whatsoever.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
That's raw.
Yeah. I have to own that. Has anyone seen Diabolique? The French film?
No.
That's what I was thinking of many times in this because of the dilapidated schoolhouse sort of vibe that was going on.
Yeah. Have you seen The Orphanage? El Orfanato?
No, that's one of the movies that I've bought that I have to wait until my wife's out of town to watch.
Yeah, because that's in the same vein as this one, but it's very much more a full-on ghost with hints of horror, but still quite beautiful, but not with as many layers as The Devil's Backbone. But it's still got that feel about it, and this is one thing that I really love about Del Toro, is his choice of location and his choice of buildings. This place was amazing. I mean, there's one corridor where it's emerald green tiled and it's just so stunning and bleak and old and quite spooky in its own right. The building itself as a character almost.
I think you have seen this film.
Yeah,
have I?
I'm jumping back to Diabolique. It's a Henry Georges Clouzot.
No, I haven't.
Because as soon as Greg said the name, I recognized the name.
Well, it's my favorite Clouseau, but you'd know if you'd seen it.
I've definitely not seen it.
The parallels to the Devil's Backbone is you've got a murder. You've got a body dumped into a big pool of water. Mm. You've got the whole dilapidated schoolhouse. Questions of whether there are witnesses. Uncertainty about whether there's even been a crime and who committed it. And I credit Diabolique with being the source of the character Columbo. Mm. 15 years later, Columbo hits the screen and he looks just like a character that's playing the detective in that movie.
Right.
But yeah, very right off the bat in Devil's Backbone, you've got a murder and you've got a body dumped into water. Mm. And from that point on, I was like, okay, well, you set the stage perfectly for me. I've been here before and had a good time when I was there.
Yeah. And I think he started writing this quite young as well. He wrote this before he wrote Kronos, certainly one of the drafts. And his first draft was set in the Mexican Civil War rather than the Spanish Civil War. But it was really very personal to him. And I do wonder just what his own experience brought to this film and quite what's so personal for him.
Maybe he escaped from an orphanage as a child.
Well,
maybe he killed an orphan.
I don't think he killed an orphan, dude. I don't think you then make a film about killing an orphan.
Word for OJ.
Kinda.
Yeah, just musing. I'm not accusing the man of anything. I'm sure he's as friendly as Pedro Almodovar is. Just thinking. Maybe he tried to steal some gold once. Maybe he's a ghost.
Well, Federico Lupi has also pretty much done all of Del Toro's films. He was in all three. Kronos, Devil's Backbone, and Pan's Labyrinth. Maybe he's the go-to guy.
Sorry, like, who
got
again?
To I've... work with him. Federico Lupi, Dr. Casares.
Ah, yes. I've lost my IMDb
page.
He's
like the main character in Kronos.
Yes, he is, of course. That's one I need to see again. Actually, I'm not sure I've actually properly seen it.
See, it's about another one of his things that he does. He likes mechanical things and he likes insects. And in this one, we've got a mechanical frog. And in Kronos, there's a mechanical beetle.
Doesn't it grab onto people or something?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
See, I think I've seen bits of it. And I'm, you know, sort of, I've been in the room while you've watched it, but I've never sat and looked at it all the way through.
Probably.
But I'd happily do that.
But that box set here that contains these three films is one of my favourite box sets that I own. And I've got a lot. Just every film in it is perfect. There's ones that I prefer. But I think Devil's Backbone is maybe not quite as perfect as Pan's Labyrinth, but I find it more beautiful.
Yeah. Do you know?
And you know what? What works for me more than anything in this is the relationship between the boys and how they just get on with it. And how those petty things get ironed out as truth unfolds and they can get on and work together to you know, overcome their adversities. Really like how the boys work together.
Well, and that explosion was incredibly realistic, considering that there hadn't been anywhere near as much visual action. I mean, he lures you in with all the subtlety, both the setting and the scenery and the way he handled the ghost. But when that explosion actually really gets ripping, it was almost war movie quality in terms of flying shrapnel and everything else. And when he breaks out the effects and turns that shift in the final act, he really, really delivered.
Yeah, he did. And it is a really big shift up in the final act, isn't it? Because you know that there's this threat of Jacinto all the time. And you don't quite know where he is when he goes away. But you get the sense that he's capable of pretty much everything. There's murder going on somewhere, I feel.
I'm wondering if that was Matt going out.
I think it was Matt going out with the dog. There was an excited bark, like, come on.
Walking the dog.
And it was either that or Jacinto has heard us speaking ill of him and something's going to explode soon.
Yes, he's now out for us.
That was funnier in my head before I said it.
He's busy pouring petrol all over the kitchen.
That's what it's like when I cook.
No, I was going to make a joke about pouring gasoline all over the kitchen, but let's go in and point the gun at whoever did it without shooting them.
Yeah.
When they pull out the lighter and light the cigarettes, you know, that's what's going to set off the gas. Maybe shoot him before he can do that.
I would have done that. I would have done that. But seriously, dude, is it like, did he say taking the dog out for a walk, or did he say he was taking the 101 Dalmatians out for a walk?
He had to take the dog out for a wrestling match.
I think he said he was going to tame a horse. I think you misunderstood him entirely.
Oh my God, it sounds like the Spanish Civil War over there.
Yeah, I'm so happy that he reset this during the Spanish Civil War, because it seems to be where his passion really was.
Yeah.
And at some point, it might be fantastic to put together a little film festival of all the sort of movies that have tried to deal either directly or elliptically with that event. Mm. Because as it's sort of described in the movie itself, it's very unlikely that the French or the English or anybody else is going to intervene. Mm. And that mountain range between France and Spain really left those people completely isolated and completely at the mercy of their countrymen.
Yeah.
And I don't know that most people have seen anything. You know, if that same thing happened in Great Britain or the United States, there'd be more movies about it than there are about Vietnam.
I think so too.
But for, yeah. How many of us can name five movies based around the Spanish Civil War?
Well, I could if I probably thought about it, but I've seen a lot of our films, and he's not afraid of getting near the effects on Spain from all those years of Franco. You know, he's quite up for discussing that. But during the time of Franco being around, I mean, in child, no one could write about this and get opinion out there or, you know, really catalogue the war, because it was so controlled.
I know absolutely nothing about it.
Exactly. Well, this is my point, exactly. So much of it was stifled that it's taken until the 70s, 80s, 90s and 2000s to start even thinking about portraying the Spanish Civil War and what it was like living under that kind of rule. It was brutal.
Yeah, I only know one example before the 70s. It was made in 1964. But if you're an American watching it, it just looks like a bunch of guys who went on a hunt and started fighting with each other. Mm. The parallels to the Civil War are so hidden underneath so many layers that you would almost have to know it to see it. Where, again, today we could see a movie that's about Vietnam but not set in Vietnam and know instantly what they're getting at.
Yeah.
So there's some movies, especially the early Carlos Saura efforts to do it. Mm. You'd almost have to be Spanish to get it.
Yeah. And certainly to understand, I've heard stories that passed down if you weren't around at the time. But, I mean, there was plenty of time of it, wasn't there? There was a huge amount of time that people in Spain were living under dictatorship, basically.
Okay.
So
yeah, to the indifference of the world. This one is probably the most accessible of all those films.
Mm. Yeah, I'd agree. And, you know, that symbolism that I was talking about, the impotency of war, really. Dr. Casares is impotent. So is that bomb sat outside in the courtyard. And people think there might be life in it. It might go off. It might not. We've just got to wait. And I think that one word is what people did during Franco's rule and the Spanish Civil War. It was wait. Because, you know, there's a line in it where Casares is talking about thinking about what came afterwards. There is no afterwards. We're still in it. There's no after at all. Right. So it's, go on.
Go, Matt.
Okay, I mean, I know very little about the Spanish Civil War like we're talking about, but I know that that's also where Germany got a lot of its combat experience, because Hitler was sending people in on a limited basis. So, I mean, outside forces were involved, because I think there was even a line in the movie about, oh, that's an international group. Like, what the heck is a Chinaman doing here in our war?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, other forces were involved, but, yeah, we don't really know to what extent.
It was just basically mercenary forces that went in there.
You know, right.
People who like a ruck, basically. You know, there's always going to be people who go to wars.
Right.
Well, I know it's a hobby of mine. I hop from war to war, just, you know.
How are things
I feel like
in
I need
Syria?
To get away. It's like, who's got an armed conflict going on?
I hear Syria's nice.
There's always a conflict somewhere, right?
Exactly.
Well, in addition to impotence, the other theme running through it is stillbirth. Yeah. The whole notion of orphans, those left behind, interrupted childhood, and the vials that the doctor has in his laboratory with essentially spiced rum substituting for formaldehyde, keeping essentially the abortion that his country has become sort of alive and on hold, so to speak.
And these mistakes shouldn't have been born and all that kind of stuff. It's abhorrent. It shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened. And so he's talking about a devil's backbone on a child, which we know is spina bifida today, but we're also talking about futility of a civil war and being suspended in animation forever.
Yeah, I was too busy having a shiver down my spine watching him drink that fluid to read as much into it as you did.
God, that was horrific, wasn't it?
It would have to come with more claims than it was coming with for me to happily drink it. youthful immortality or something. You know, not just,
another movie popped into my head when I saw that scene, though?
What?
Zorro.
Yes. Mask of Zorro with Antonio Banderas.
We talked about him a lot tonight.
It was the instant he started lowering that ladle down to the jar, I said, oh, I know what I'm thinking of now.
Right.
If it had got a cocktail umbrella out or ice and a slice, I'd have been out of there. But, you know, he just did a quick neck.
You
do. Fine.
You shot it.
You've got a shot, haven't you?
Dead baby juice or whatever.
You shot it, but that delay between when the boy left the room and when he actually took the shot was kind of Hitchcockian.
It
I was anticipating
time,
bang.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like he was making up his mind either. He'd made up his mind. Oh, he was just, you know, I'm going to do it. It was like, you know, people who like do stuff like, you know, bungee jumping.
Yeah.
You know, they're on the bridge with the gear on them. They're going to do it.
Yeah.
But there's that moment of saying, you know, all right, now.
What blew my mind is that he didn't do it in front of the audience that he'd set up. You know, the whole speech was, if you're going to believe in ghosts, you might as well drink this in the belief you'll make you better. But so he knows there's no...
I love the foreshadowing.
Yeah, there's no cure for anything in there. He's got no audience, and yet he still drinks it. Dirty man. And then later we see him selling bottles.
There was never a moment for me. When he filled the shot glass with it and he offers it to Carlito, who then runs away, there was no doubt in my mind that the doctor regularly treats himself to a shot of this every once in a while. It's not something that he, you know, okay, I sell this all the time, maybe I should go ahead. Okay, I'll take it. No, he will use that possibly, to my mind, possibly even nightly. He'll just, you know, have one.
Do you reckon? Do you think he believes well, what he's told the kid to not believe?
I think so. It's certain. With him drinking the rum, it didn't strike me as something that he had never done before, and he decided just to give it a try. He knows what it is. I think that's one of his little secrets, is he'll have a drink.
But he can only really drink down to within about 2 mil of the top of the baby's head, and then it's wrong. If you go down, if you're taking ladle after ladle out, and then it crowns, you've got to stop.
It's the bit at the bottom that...
Oh,
no.
Give up now.
I think it just shows that men who run orphanages have weird habits. I mean, it's like Michael Caine in Cider House Rules on his ether.
And all those hostile
films.
So then
It's wrong. I mean, if you were listening on a every other nightly basis to the woman you've been in love with for decades, even when her husband was alive, getting screwed by this punk who used to be her student, who then says all kinds of hideously rude and demeaning things to her during and after their sexual encounters.
While he's nicking keys.
You know you can hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know you can hear it because you know she can hear your poetry, so you know she knows you can hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might develop a drinking problem.
Yeah.
He just didn't have any harder drugs around.
Yeah, that's probably true. If they were in like modern day Madrid, he'd be jacked up every day.
That's what it takes.
Yeah.
That's it.
Just, well, yeah. He absolutely adores her. And he's the only one who can give Carmen the kind of love and poetry and romance that she craves. But old rough boy outside is just there for the shag and the keys. He doesn't really care. He doesn't really want to shag her. He's got nice Conchita outside, who's much prettier and much younger. So it's not even about an attraction for him. He's using her all the way just to take key by key and try and find the key to that safe.
The safe that there's nothing.
So in some ways, the doctor's already the ghost.
Say that again, sorry?
One of the mysteries is right up front. In some ways, the doctor is already the ghost. I mean, right up front, you get the definition and the question of what is a ghost, and it raises the question of who is a ghost.
Yeah.
And at first, you think it's just the narrator. You get to the end, and you realize, no, this is your narrator has been the ghost all along, and it's not Santi. It's him. But he's been a ghost inside the life of the woman he loves, and the ghost in the lives of those kids.
Yeah. The ghost of her father that they've all lost. Yep. Their fathers might be dead, they might be alive. The kids think they're hoping, they're doing that, yeah, my dad's coming back for me, kind of thing. But we get shown that that's probably not going to happen. People are getting picked up. And these kids' dads are the people who are getting picked up. You know, it's not an accident. These kids are from dissident dads. So, yeah, he is a ghost. And then becomes one. For reals. And it's beautiful because he says, I'll never leave here. I'll always look after you. I promise that I'll never leave here. And he meant it.
Yeah.
And when he gets scared, it's his fear and his fear reaction that triggers all of the tragedy.
Yeah.
You know, he's convinced that somehow the army's going to come to the orphanage. There's a 50-50 chance he's right. But really, as a military target goes, there's bigger fish to fry.
Hell's yeah.
But once he opens up the safe and starts packing up, it all goes to hell from there.
It does really, doesn't it? Because Jacinto only really starts doing all that when he thinks that his chance of the gold has gone. The gold being kept for the cause, really. It's for the cause, but heck, you need the money now. You need this gold. But he's always had his eye on it from forever. And that's his only prize there. He cares about no one.
Well, and that gold is its own trap. Because to these kids, having milk and bread for breakfast was going to be such a delicacy that the doctor knew that he could use that as a trap to find out who was lying and who was telling the truth. But they're not poor. They have this gold. They could do some things, fix the place up, buy some food, except you can't exactly go into town with a bar of gold.
Yeah, there's no gold.
So you've got an incredibly valuable property.
Yeah.
Hey, you can't negotiate that. If anybody finds out you got gold at the orphanage, then the last act would have happened a lot sooner, probably with a whole band of people from town.
Yeah.
Right.
But I love that he's literally hoist by his own petard, really. Because we get shown the murder of Santi and what happened there. And Santi saw him trying to open the safe with one of the stolen keys. And that was the end of him. You know, he was silenced, basically. And he was in shock with the head injury. He wasn't dead. But Jacinto weighted him down and put him in the mysterious pit. Then he steals gold and lays himself down with weight. It's wonderful.
It was his actions that we were shown in that flashback near the end that showed one of the big misdirections of the movie that I didn't see coming until we got to that flashback. When we saw at the beginning, we see Santi on the ground with the head wound. Mm. We see him in the water, and we see Jaime at the edge of the pool.
Yeah.
And I made the assumption, well, first off, I made the assumption that Jaime was the one that found him. I assumed he was already dead, and Jaime just disposed of the body to hide him one way or the other, for whatever reason. Mm. The second mistake of mine was not realizing that this was a flashback at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Because We only got that quick glimpse of Santi, and he kind of looks a bit like Carlito. Mm. So when the movie started, I thought it was a flash forward. I thought we were seeing the end of the story.
Huh.
And then we flash back to see how it happened. It took me a while to realize that wasn't Carlito that was on the ground bleeding from the head. That was someone else.
So I
was confused.
Well, that's a good state to be in, I think, when you get into that flashback and everything is revealed, like, ha ha. Whereas, I think even when I first saw it, I get such a bad feeling about Jacinto that I just despise him and know that he is the downfall of everything here. He is the spark that could set up a huge fire. Maybe it's because I find him so repellent that I can't help but thinking that it's all down to him from the start. I'm trying to not look at it through the eyes of someone who's seen it before. Yeah, he's severe.
Mm-hmm. Everything he does is nasty. Every interaction he has with the kids, he's always much more harsh than is required.
Mm.
Near the end, when we see the flashback and he finds Santi and he says, "Did you see the safe?" I said, "Well, it doesn't matter if he saw it or not. Now he knows there's a safe because you told him. Way to go,
right?
Idiot."
when he has Carlito by the shirt and he has the knife to him and reminds him, "If anything happens to you, I get the blame. Here, now let me cut your face and I'll get blamed for it."
Horrible.
Way to go, idiot. Why are you setting yourself up for failure this way?
Idiot. He's just all testosterone and no brain cells. He's dangerous. He's dangerous from the very beginning. And Carmen says she's known that as well. You know, he's a prince without a kingdom. I mean, that's a dangerous person. Prince without a kingdom is one that takes
it. I think
the only person that does not see that he is just pure evil underneath a nearly Zachary Quinto esque visage is Conchita. She's the only one that doesn't get how bad he is until she sees it in front of her face.
I think she's scared of him.
Right.
See, I would agree that Jacinto is basically the personification of macho bullshit.
Yeah.
Yes. And that
Conchita's doing the best she can with the situation she's got. So you can almost cut her a little bit of slack.
Yeah.
And he's the product of this school. So Carmen's kind of stuck with him, too.
Mm.
So it really is kind of an indictment of sort of that element of that sort of what we might call that Latin culture. It's true in America. It's also true in Central America and in Spain, that sort of macho BS.
Yeah. Very much so. And she's kind of trapped now. There's no choice, is there?
Go ahead, Matt.
I got the feeling that Carmen might have suspected he was going through her keys at one point. Because right when she gives Carlito saying, "Here's your locker key," she kind of goes, "Wait a minute, there's a key missing."
Mm.
So I kind of got the feeling she was onto him earlier in the movie than everyone else was. But she wasn't sure, so she didn't do anything about it.
Well, maybe if it's just a cleaning cupboard key, then she's not going to be suspecting, because he's just taking random keys and trying, isn't he?
Right.
So it might be a meaningless key that's gone.
Right. I don't know, it kind of rang to me like she might have suspected him, but then kind of, again, passed it off and didn't really think about it until the end.
Mm. I certainly think that both she and Casares must have known that he was capable of darkness. They must have seen him. They must have.
Absolutely.
You know, you can't raise a child into an adult and not see him behave badly towards other human beings, ever. You just can't. It's going to happen. So they must have known that he was quite capable. And, you know, if we get back to why it's called the Devil's Backbone and why he's got that jar and that phrase, it shouldn't have been born, it's an aberration. It's kind of him. He's the darkness amongst them all.
That's true, yeah.
And they're just trying to survive against the odds in Civil War. And he's the one who's not altruistic. Everybody else is altruistic and thinks of the greater good and the fight together, but him.
Okay, have we about?
So I have.
Oh, go ahead. Gosh, the Skype is not doing well this week.
I was going to say, I came into sort of this recording with a complaint about the movie, and I'm not. It's risky to open up a Pan's Labyrinth kind of can of worms here, but. I'm watching the movie. Yeah. I'm watching the movie and I'm saying to myself, it is still possible. For most of the film, it was still possible that the ghost of Santi was simply something that these boys had constructed.
Yeah.
That at no point does Santi do anything that has to be real. And that's really true all the way to the end of the movie. When Santi whispers, "Bring him to me," is that Santi or is it the idea that occurs to Carlos that he can murder the murderer the same way the murderer murdered the other boy. Mm. Where it falls down is when the ghost of the doctor unlocks the door and lets them out of that room they're locked into. Now, for the first time in the film, you actually have a real ghost really doing something. And I was going to hold it against the film for not holding that balance of either one of these possibilities as true, except for the fact that you get to the end of the movie and you realize, no, all along, he's the only real ghost there is. He's the ghost who's telling you the ghost. So if he's the one who's magically unlocking doors because he's coming from beyond the grave, it works. I cut it some slack over it.
Well, I still think that Santi does interact with his physical world to get attention. He's the one who knocks over the pitcher of water and then makes footprints in that water. I didn't see that as an accident. I saw that as I'm going to make my presence known now. Here's the water. Here's my footprints. So, I don't know. Where I'm at with it is, it comes down to that. Are we going to let ourselves believe in ghosts? Because if we are, we've got to believe in both of them. We can't pick and choose.
But if the movie had, instead of the doctor actually being the one to unlock that door, if instead it had been the little kid and his explanation for how he was able to get on his feet and walk over there was that the doctor helped him walk, if it was the kid's fingerprints on the door handle, you could have gotten all the way to the end of the movie with only perhaps a childhood fantasy and a moment of incredible fear explaining almost all of it, which would have been pretty cool, except I much rather have the explanation of who the narrator is. And I'm willing to take the ghost story as the prize. Mm. He had a way out.
The more I think about it, the more I like that view of it.
See, I'm still with that he was alive until he died.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know what I mean? He was alive until
he died.
That's
old-fashioned of you, isn't it?
I know, it's terribly traditionalist of me, but I just feel that... as a group delusion, it's fairly huge because it's not just the children who see Dr. Casares. It's Carmen. It's the other teachers. It's Jacinto. It's everybody. Everyone can see this old guy. He even has a conversation with people out in the street. So he must be alive
he
dies.
I give the doctor being alive the whole time until he dies, but he's telling us the story from after death.
Yeah.
And his one act of letting the boys free is after death. And perhaps even the idea of coming back came the mythology that there was this other ghost story that had, for at least I would have wished the other ghost story had been older. It felt like it was only a few months old.
Yeah,
it would
have been better if
Santi's story was more than a year old.
I don't know, I quite like the idea of a fresh ghost, certainly one that's matured for a year.
Fresh and still bleeding. Still bleeding while bleeding upwards in the current while walking around. I don't think I'd seen an effect like that before. I really don't.
No.
Yeah, that was a pretty pretty well done effect.
And like, you know, this is quite old now, this film.
Yeah. I did enjoy the effect on his wound. I mean, not just the blood coming out, but the fact that his head looked kind of shattered, yeah, like porcelain.
It was a chunk out.
Well, it was cracked. It was
well,
like
you could see his skeleton underneath.
Yeah.
His like opaque skin, couldn't you?
It's very well.
It's amazingly well done.
But he's
2001.
He's a friendly ghost because he's their old mate.
Yeah, didn't you compare it to Casper?
It's more like that than anything else. It is. It's quite like that. He's a friendly ghost. He's not out to get the kids. That's what makes it not a horror film.
Right. It's Casper meets The Ring.
Yeah. Casper meets The
Ring. I can see that.
I'd say that would be a disturbing film, but no, that film is The Devil's Backbone. You're absolutely right. Ghosts get a bad reputation.
If only he'd call a few people on the phone, it would really be perfect.
Can I tell a story about The Ring, even though it's certainly not the movie we're discussing, but now that it's been mentioned, can I tell a little story?
Yeah,
sure.
All right, has everyone seen The Ring?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, both.
No.
The original and the
American remake.
The premise of The Ring is there's a videotape that gets passed around. You put the videotape in, you watch it, it's a lot of disturbing imagery, goes on for a bit, and then after you watch it, your phone rings, and you answer the phone, and you're going to be dead in a week. So,
yeah.
Group of us are all together. We have just finished watching the movie. Everyone's a little creeped out because it is a tense movie. One of the special features on the DVD is, and I think it's a hidden special feature, but if you find it, it will show you all the content from that videotape. It's as though you're watching that tape. You could see that video.
No.
It plays for you on the DVD. So the group that's all together, we're at the house and we watch that special feature, and no one in the room except for me notices that the friend of mine who owns the house, she has secreted her cell phone behind her on the couch. And dials their landline and waits for the film for that little video bit to be over. And then she hits send and their phone rings in the living room.
Wonderful.
Now, this is back before I got married. And my fiance was there in the room. She freaked out. She absolutely lost her mind with fear. It was one of the funniest things I ever saw. It was worth the fact that every time the story was told afterwards, she got incredibly mad because she couldn't take the joke. She was very bad at taking jokes.
Okay.
So she was offended every time I told the story.
All
but
evil bastards.
It was so worth it. It was so worth it. It was amazing.
That's epic.
Wasn't that?
It reminds me of...
Go on, Greg.
December 31st, 1999, six couples and all their kids were at my house. We had a party. And during the course of the evening, when you end up like five or 10 minutes, ball drops, you're all sitting in the living room watching TV, you know, watching the big thing.
Yeah.
And during the course of the evening, I'd shut off every light, unplugged night lights, just basically kind of darkened up the house to where when the ball drops and they're counting down 3, 2, 1, I'd hidden the remote control in the couch cushion next to me and turned the TV off right as they got to zero. We're sitting there, drunk people in absolute darkness. It happened, man. It really happened. The problem was I didn't get any of the kids drunk, and they were the ones who figured it out. I was probably smiling too much in the dark.
Yeah, probably. Just
Dad did it.
Homer Simpson teeth just in the darkness.
Well, I think it's time to give...
For those 14 seconds.
Yeah.
Oh, you were...
For those 14 seconds, it was hilarious.
King. You were king.
Right, well, let's battle through our Skype lag, and I think we should give this film some scores. So, I'll try and remember the order we started in. It was Greg, first of all, I think. Give this film a score out of 5, please.
I'm going to go with 4. And the thing that holds me back is that I'm very worried at the end of the movie about the fate of these kids. It's one of these films where if you show the 5 minutes after the movie's over, it's pretty damn grim because I don't like their chances.
No, me
either.
So I'll
give it a 4.
I thought it was a shame they didn't end up with the gold because they really bloody needed it. More than anyone else, those kids needed that gold. And no, it's just at the bottom of that.
Owl could have definitely done with a bit of a motorized wheelchair.
I was going to say, it's the one with the broken ankle. He died days later.
Broken ankle and a stick.
He didn't even...
It's a day to town if you can walk. Yeah,
he didn't even make it to the next town. You're absolutely right. It's a bleak story the next couple of weeks. Matt, what do you think?
I'm going to give it a solid 4. I really, really enjoyed it, coming into it and expecting something completely different than what I got. And I definitely enjoyed what I got. So 4.
Cool. Scott?
I'm going to have to say the same. This will log in as a solid 4. It's very meticulously and beautifully put together. There are aspects of the story that we've seen in other movies before. It's not the most original and groundbreaking story ever, but it's presented in such a lovely way that it's completely enjoyable, even if it's not blowing your mind with surprises. I think I would almost certainly have given it a 5 if they had found a way to have Ron Perlman play the unexploded bomb. But with no Ron Perlman as the unexploded bomb, then we'll have to say it's a 4.
Cool. Now, Alice,
I can understand that.
This film doesn't have either Ryan Gosling or Michael Fassbender, so I've written your 3 down already.
No, so, that's unfair.
What? Sorry?
I'm not getting invited onto many shows here, so I've been presented with some really good films with fit people in and some diabolical films. And therefore, that's how my scores have come out.
You're on plenty of shows.
What is guiding me is the strength of Guillermo del Toro's work, full stop. The quality as they're viewed together. And every performance out of this film, I think, is stunning. And I think because it's such a personal story for him, it really comes across well for me. So, there's nobody really fit in it. And it's not as bad as Rounders. So it's got to be a 4.
You're absolutely... saying 4, that's correct, Alice.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It is 4. Everyone else says
didn't,
so.
Did I make that clear that I'm actually asking you for an answer to a question that I'm not asking?
Yeah.
It's not a score. You either get it right or you get it wrong. I don't know what else to tell you.
Well, I believe we've all right tonight. I think universally we are all right tonight.
And 4 fours are?
16.
16. The Devil's Backbone, 16. Better than Ghost Watching Desperado, not quite Network.
Not quite, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Network
you see,
has
this
the
is
big
how
legendary
I,
bits.
I've done
no one's...
The 3 films that I've done in the last 24 hours have been Network, Desperado, and Devil's Backbone.
Yeah.
It's been a nice little... assortment of films to watch that.
And the highest scoring of all of them was Ghostwatch. I know you didn't do Ghostwatch, did you?
No, I didn't do Ghostwatch.
How did
Ghostwatch get higher than Network?
It didn't really, I'm only joking.
Oh, that's okay then. If that had happened, I'd have
cancelled all further recordings and burned the archives if that had happened. Then it would have.
Well, I'd be as mad as hell.
Yeah,
exactly.
Then it would have turned out that all this time we've been a force for evil. That's what would have happened. It would be very bad. So
no longer 21st century entertainment. Now a force for evil.
Yeah. I think that was a pivot I had been sort of wondering about for Simply Syndicated. What if we just do evil? I could get that layer of always being
something
after.
That you decide, you know.
Oh, you do.
I think I'm going to be markedly more evil than I've been.
There's much more money in evil than there is in podcasting.
This is very true.
Look at the oil business.
Isn't there usually a lab accident?
Yeah. Oh, that was years ago.
You need a lab accident to turn evil.
Right.
I'll get working on that, actually. There must be a lab near here.
We will know that we've become truly evil. We'll know we've become truly evil if we do an episode of Movies You Should See discussing Peter Jackson's Dead Alive while we're all eating custard.
I'm out that day. I'm definitely not working that day. Can I eat the custard?
I will watch that movie. I'll watch that movie any day of the week. And say, if you want to do an episode for that movie, I will call off work to do Dead Alive.
Wow.
I'll give it a watch and see what we think then. I don't know. I'd do it. I'm up for anything. I don't care anymore. It's good. We've got to potentially find a bad film anyway. I'm not saying that Dead or Alive is a bad film, but we've got to find one. Because I feel bad for Casey that it's Rounders. It's the worst film we've scored. So
yeah.
We
do feel kind of really sorry that we don't like it.
We need to find a film that four
really
people are going to give
mate.
A one or a two score to. That's what needs to happen.
Well, what needs to happen basically is I need to get more honest and start giving this detritus twos when it really deserves a two.
I don't know. You're not going to win the Jurassic Park argument. That's just not going to happen.
I wouldn't have given Jurassic Park a two.
Three was sacrilegious enough.
Three's all you're getting.
There you go, you see. Destroying Ryan Gosling, you get yourself a five, though. That's how it goes. I know. I'm only teasing now. I can hear the eyes rolling from behind the microphone.
It's actually not my eyes, it's my real teeth grinding.
Oh, I'm going to be injured soon. Yeah. Oh, I see. I see. Well, thank you guys for coming and doing the show. I feel I kind of want to prolong it now because I'm only going to get hurt in the next 10 minutes.
Will you stop, please, insinuating to people that I am violent towards you?
She's never been violent towards me.
Honestly, if I do one day go postal, I'm really going to pull it out, you know. Well, I'm just being what you said I was all along. Ha ha.
Yeah, she's not violent. I deserve it.
Anyway. That's what the victims always say, isn't it, Richard?
Yeah, but I'm right.
I deserve it. I was asking for it.
I'm really right. It's one of those situations where if you actually did attack me, our friends would hear about it and go, I'm surprised she waited this long. Not even lasted this long, but waited this long. Yeah. Like it was an inevitability.
It's just like that UX being.
You would have run into a door a long time ago,
exactly.
Buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. No.
That's a funny way to break your hand.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for listening, everybody. You can go and, do you know what? You can go and listen to the sort of 240 archived episodes of this show that are all extremely different. And Simply Everything, which you can hear at, which you can sign up for at simplysyndicated.com/everything. It's our little subscription service that gives you everything we've ever done, and then some. And you can hear these guys on other podcasts. Greg of Inappropriate Conversations is inappropriateconversations.org.
Yes, it is. And if I could make a recommendation for one of those archival shows, if you're listening to this one, you owe it to yourself to go back and find the Movies You Should See episode for Pan's Labyrinth with a special guest from America. So yeah. That seems like the sister film and the sister episode.
Yeah.
And and for me, Inappropriate Conversations is my audio blog, inappropriateconversations.org. Every mistake I've ever made and everything I've ever done right is still up on the website.
Awesome.
Excellent. The way it should be. Leave the evidence trail.
Scott, you'll find on the...
Thanks for reminding me. That was Laurie on that show, by the way. That was awesome. We had an American in our house.
She came here and
she
everything.
She came here. She spilled tea all over.
Did she?
But still love her. We adore Laurie. And we're so grateful that she came all the way from Bumfuck, Texas, or Cleveland, or wherever it is.
Illinois,
that's it. Bumfuck Illinois.
Bumfuck's in Alabama.
Is it?
Yeah.
I thought it was East Bumfuck, Texas. I don't know. Anyway, she came a long way.
I gotta, I got a great bumfuck makes me think. I got to tell this story. I got a friend at work who has six male friends who are all somewhat diminutive and apparently very attractive, who agreed for Halloween to dress up as sheep and go out to parties with him. And he was Bo Peep.
Oh my God.
That's spectacular.
That's pretty cool.
That's amazing.
That's pretty cool. I don't think I've got that kind of power over small women. I like that. It's good.
Scott, you can find it at the White Star 5 podcast of the Simply Syndicated Federation. Should we do a pretend? How's it going so far,
it's
Scott?
It's going awesome. Even I loved being on the pilot. That was awesome. It was great.
It's been nothing but a barrel of spoo. And spoo. For anyone who is a fan of Babylon, anyone who is a fan of Babylon 5 will know what I mean when I say it's a barrel of spoo.
I don't know what you mean.
Trust me, it's a good thing. Look it up.
Yes.
Cool. Matt, do you have anything we can direct people to? Or
Blog's up. Hold on, I haven't done to it in so long, I've got to remember it myself. Zupkaspeaks.blogspot.com. It's semi-regularly updated. But that's about all I got online.
Cool. Well, let's throw it out there. People might go and look at it. I don't know how many people are listening to us in the first place, though, so I can't promise anything. So thank you for listening, everybody.
It's fine.
Thank you for listening, and thank you to our wonderful guests again. It's been a great pleasure having you on. We'll be back soon with another show featuring more clever people talking about films, and me as well. So, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.